Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests, two segments today, you may be shocked to learn. Mossab Baba, a researcher on Sudan, will talk about the civil war in that country, one of the most miserable regions in the world. And Jake Adelstein, an American journalist who's been living in Japan for almost 40 years, will report on Japan's new prime minister, who, among other things, is a bit of a Hitler fangirl. I've been watching the humanitarian catastrophe in Sudan for some time now, but like many provincial Americans, really had little idea of what was going on. I'd resolved to address that lack, but it wasn't until I read Mossab Baba's piece on the Black Agenda Report website that I found a way into understanding and covering it. The current civil war dates to 2023, but Sudan has a long history of conflict and political instability, much of it amplified by outside actors with their own interests. The human toll has been extraordinary. 12 million people have been displaced, an unknown but high number of people have died or gone missing. Millions are on the verge of starvation. Why? Here with more is Mossab Baba, a researcher and activist who specializes in the country. As is always the case with these things, where do we start? I mean, in Sudan's case, British colonialism, I suppose, would be a good place to start, but we've only got a certain amount of time. So let's just focus on the war, the current civil war. Who are the parties? How did it all get going? And who are the external actors? Well, let's start with the parties to the war, which started in 2023. Who are the principal antagonists?
Right. So the principal antagonists there's the main armed forces of Sudan, the Sudan Armed Forces, abbreviated by SAF. And the other side is the Rapid Support Forces, abbreviated by the RSF. And they were both part of the Bashir regime.
And Bashir, he was overthrown in 2019. When did he take power? What was his reign like?
So that's kind of the roots of this current war. Bashir took power in 1989. The brief just trajectory of things is that in the late 70s, there was the dictator Nimeiri. Nimeiri basically went into kind of the U.S. policy fold, welcomed by Reagan and Bush and these guys, and basically was their man in the area. He was removed by a popular uprising in 1985. We saw 3 years of democracy from 1986 until 1989. And then 1989, Bashir took over. Basically, Bashir's regime was a theocratic dictatorship. And it kind of, you know, the war in South Sudan was already going on at that time. But the Bashir regime came and gave that war kind of a jihadist creed to fight that war. But within that was also the Arab Islamic identity of Sudan that they kind of came and cemented and forced on the rest of Sudan. Since then, things have been haywire in Sudan.
Sudan is a country with many religious groups and ethnic groups, right? So there are plenty of natural fissures within the population.
Yes, exactly. You know, mostly indigenous groups, you know, non-Arab groups, especially before the separation of South Sudan. So this was seen as a move to make other non-Arab, non-Muslim groups as being second-class citizens. That's what eventually led to the separation of South Sudan and them becoming independent. But throughout those 30 years, from 1989 to 2019, the Bashir regime has been heavy on doing counterinsurgencies. You know, there was the rebellion in South Sudan, then the rebellion in the Nuba Mountains, then in Blue Nile, and then the rebellion in Darfur in 2003. And that's where you saw kind of a lot of your older listeners might remember the Save Darfur movement in the 2000s. That's basically where the rebellion that started in Darfur. Bashir used the Janjaweed militia. So this is kind of the strain that continues to this day in this current war, is creating the Janjaweed militia. Then after South Sudan was separated, they legitimized the Janjaweed militia. It became the RSF. And 2019, Bashir was removed. The RSF actually came into Khartoum and, you know, as a partner with the army, but separate. So this was a point of contention, like since 2017 or so, of is the RSF part of the army or is it something separate? this was kind of one of the main contradictions that kind of led to this war right now, because you ended up having two armies in the country. You have the official army and then you had the RSF.
What are the bases of these two armies? Do they have any popular support? Where's it come from? What is their basis of support?
So SAF is the official army. So it you know, typically had heavy support in the center of the country and the north. The rest of the areas, you know, had SAF bases and everything, but the support was coming mostly from the ruling party. So there wasn't, you know, popular support for SAF except for people wanting to defend themselves and wanting SAF to defend them from, you know, banditry or whatever, but no popular support per se. You know, it was something that was more imposed on the people of Sudan. The RSF, on the other hand, because they recruit by tribes. So their tribes are mostly like, you know, the Arab tribes of the West, mostly pastoralist and nomadic groups. That's their main constituency. And that's kind of the biggest problems, was that the RSF, since day one, their recruitment method has been through tribes rather than, you know, individual recruitment. So if you want to kind of draw out where the heavy support or, you know, constituents for them, you know, the SAF would be in the center in the north and the RSF would be in the west.
Bashir was overthrown in 2019. Why and by whom?
So this was a popular movement, a popular nonviolent movement that was simmering for a long time. You know, the first spark was pretty much in 2013, where you had like huge protests in Sudan for different reasons. Some people more the austerity measures and, you know, the looting of the country's resources. But there was a bigger undercurrent of being against genocides. And 2019 was the first time that the movement was centered in Khartoum, but it had support from all of the countries. So the constituents in Darfur and the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile and Eastern Sudan in the far north were all supportive of this movement to remove Bashir, because it came on the heels of a long tradition of, you know, nonviolent uprisings, but also the opposition and the opposition parties and movements were united since like 2014. So it was kind of an amalgamation of all of these grievances that people had both in the center and the peripheries of Sudan, and it materialized in this movement in 2019. Which started in December 2018, but, you know, had like 5 months of protests after that.
Now, Sudan has experienced something like 20 coup attempts, periods of military rule, two earlier civil wars that went on for decades. This is not a happy history in this country.
Nope, not at all. Not at all. It's a very tumultuous history. And the common thread among this is always the central Khartoum government, along with their military tactics and counterinsurgency tactics. And that's basically how they stayed in power, you know, for so long, and kind of mobilizing people to fight for them, fighting the South Sudanese, fighting the Nuba Mountains, fighting people in Darfur. And then they ran out of people to recruit, you know, regular recruitment. So that's when they went and got the Janjaweed militias and started creating the RSF.
What keeps it all going? This is a horrendously bloody and misery-inducing war. Why does it keep going?
Well, the Bashir regime were kind of masters at towing the line between Western policies and between looking towards the East. So they, for example, you know, they were pretty tight with Iran and Russia and China, especially in the 90s. But then in 2014, Bashir completely let go of that, of those countries, and he went under the umbrella of the Gulf Arab countries, specifically the UAE and Saudi Arabia, with Egypt being close by. So since 2014, that's where you had kind of a revitalizing of the Bashir regime and all of his forces. The war in Yemen was fought primarily by Sudanese soldiers, you know, recruited by the UAE and Saudi Arabia, you know, through, of course, the consent of the Bashir regime. You also had things like the European Union paying the Bashir regime and working with them so they can quell migration. And of course, the main force that was used to control the so-called migration was this RSF force. They've gotten lifelines time and time again, and they know kind of how, you know, Sudan was on the country of seven countries in 5 years from the Project for the New American Century in the late 90s. You know, they were on the list for regime change, but a compromise that the Bashir regime made was letting South Sudan separate and become its own country. So it's these kind of moves that helped them survive for this long.
Yeah, Bashir at one point was afraid he was going to be the next Saddam Hussein, right, and find himself hanged.
Absolutely.
In America.
Yep.
Under American supervision.
Yeah, he saw what happened in Iraq. He saw what happened in Afghanistan. He saw what happened in these countries, you know. And so during that first, like post 9/11, the compromise was to let South Sudan go. But then when the Arab Spring came along in 2011, this was his kind of second wave of him kind of thinking, is he the next Gaddafi? Is he the next, you know, Bashar al-Assad or, you know, the Yemeni president or someone? So that's when he decided to actually play ball with them. So he actually assisted in the removal of Gaddafi from Libya. So he kind of fully went into the fold of the U.S. policy and regime change and stuff. Master hustler.
Bad karma, though, to help on that task.
Oh, it destabilized the entire region. You're right. That Libya overthrow, we're suffering to it till this day. And that's one of the reasons why you have a militia like the RSF being able to move freely between Sudan and Libya and Chad and Niger and all of these countries.
Okay, we talked about this a little bit, but let's go into some more detail. There are a lot of external actors here. China, mm-hmm. Ukraine, Saudi Arabia, UAE. Who are these major foreign players?
So the major players, the SAF is primarily supported by Egypt. You know, Egypt, you know, having even a pre-colonial history with Sudan, you know, militarily, you know, Egypt kind of, you know, helped the Turks and the British colonize Sudan. So that Egyptian military and the Sudanese military have a bond that's never been fully kind of decoupled completely. You know, partially, it's not by their choice, more the restrictions on the region. You know, they're bordering Israel and, you know, they're pretty tight with the U.S. and everything. So there's always been a tendency to keep Sudan in check. And Egypt's kind of stronger relations with the SAF, even helping them out during this war and everything. On the other hand, the RSF is primarily backed by the UAE. You know, the UAE is kind of the bigger, more dangerous supporter because they're supporting a non-state actor and they're working with Sudan's neighbors as well, like Chad and South Sudan and everything to indirectly support the RSF. So those are the two main backers of the two sides.
I'm speaking with Mossab Baba, a specialist in the politics of Sudan. What are their interests? Why are they doing these things?
So Egypt's interest is more geostrategic as far as, you know, Sudan, because, you know, all the Nile waters, whether it's the Blue Nile or the White Nile or the River Nile, they all go through Sudan into Egypt. Egypt without the Nile water is pretty much a desert. So that's one critical thing for them. The other thing is resources. Livestock is a huge source for food for, you know, whether it's for Egypt or the Arab Gulf. Agricultural land, feeding these desert areas in the Arab Gulf and in Egypt. A lot of agricultural projects in Sudan go to Egypt. So it's an extractive economy is one of them. The other thing is the regional hegemony. Like Egypt doesn't want Sudan to get close to Ethiopia, for example. They have a big problem with the Ethiopian Grand Renaissance Dam, which is a huge success for Ethiopia, but makes it an energy leader in the region. So that also takes away from Egypt's hegemony and basically Sudan's financial ties with Egypt. The same thing with the UAE, but the UAE is doing it on a bigger scale. You know, Egypt is most concerned about the countries along the Nile, Sudan and South Sudan and Ethiopia. But the UAE has a bigger, first of all, resources and then seaports, because they always wanted to use the Red Sea, Sudan's ports along the Red Sea, and kind of control that Red Sea trade route. So that's pretty critical, you know, on an international level. But also the gold industry, you know, after South Sudan separated, you know, they had most of the oil. So after that, the gold became the number one export in Sudan. And some estimates are saying that Sudan is the third leading gold producer in the world. Unfortunately, most of it is smuggled. A lot of it is just sold to the UAE. And in turn, the UAE has supported the RSF because the RSF controls a lot of gold mines in Sudan. But the UAE has a bigger game as far as working in the Horn of Africa and East Africa. They have a lot of big, you know, investments and security arrangements. they wanted to play a bigger security role in the region, you know, starting with the war on Yemen, you know, working with warlords like Haftar in Libya, arming Chad, Central African Republic, Ethiopia. They have a really strong connection with Addis Ababa. They have a strong connection with Somaliland, Puntland within Somalia. So it's basically wherever they can get their hands on resources or geostrategic locations, they're moving in with really deep pockets, unfortunately.
And is the U.S. involved?
The U.S. is involved. The U.S. is involved more on the military and the security stuff indirectly. The reason we don't see a lot of coverage on Sudan is because both Egypt and the UAE are very close U.S. allies. You know, they have been keeping, upholding the U.S. policy and Israel policy, of course, in the region. You know, so that's why when you follow the money and the guns, they're strictly within the U.S. policy umbrella. But also the U.S., you know, they kind of played both sides. You know, they let Egypt and the UAE kind of dictate the security arrangements in Sudan. And the U.S. was kind of supporting, you know, the civilian government of Hamdok, supporting civil society, stuff like that, kind of more lightweight things. But the heavier lifting was kind of outsourced to Egypt and the UAE. And the U.S. was, you know, very instrumental in pressuring Bashir and putting him on the regime change list, sanctions, pushing for the South Sudan independence. Even during the transitional period, the first Trump regime was pressuring the transitional government to normalize with Israel, you know, the Abraham Accords. But it also came with other things like paying for the victims of the USS Cole, the bombing that happened way back in 2000. Paying for the embassy bombings in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in 1998. You know, and it's kind of like, okay, this is a transitional government that removed Bashir, the government that was harboring terrorism. Why are you penalizing the transitional government? So the U.S. was definitely involved in it. And unfortunately, they left most of the work, the lifting for the for these countries like the UAE and Egypt.
I read that China is also supplying some arms. What's their interest, if any?
China by third party. China hasn't really had tight relations with Sudan for a long time. They were the ones who actually moved in most of the oil fields in the 90s. They did a lot of some of the infrastructure in the 90s and the early 2000s. But I think Sudan like defaulted on its loans a long time ago with China, and China hasn't like set foot in Sudan for like 20 years. But the Chinese weapons market, of course, is wide open. You know, the UAE buys weapons from China, SAF buys weapons from China, you know, not directly, but through like third party suppliers.
And Sudan, being a very, very poor country, must rely on foreign assistance for purchasing these arms.
That's why you have like 90%, over 90% of the budget going towards the war effort. And you have all of the money that's going from the gold exports, and we're talking about billions of dollars. These are all going to buy these weapons. Now, I do not doubt at all that they piled up a lot of debt, especially since the beginning of the war, to actually fund the war. You know, so also like future generations might be stuck with a pretty heavy bill.
Now, the degree of suffering in Sudan now, the hunger, the displacement, all the casualties of war, the World Food Program says it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Could you just lay out the dimensions of this suffering? How bad is it?
It's just mind-boggling, you know, how big the crisis is versus how much coverage it's getting. I mean, there's over 12 million people displaced. You know, that's between people displaced internally and people who had to flee the country as refugees. 12 million people being displaced, usually that would be a headline that should stop the whole world, and everyone should pay attention and, you know, work towards stopping this war. But that hasn't happened. I think there's also, you know, it's a country in Africa. So the priority when it comes to the international level becomes less and less, you know, unfortunately, the darker you are. The hunger crisis is, you know, you have over 20 million people in dire need of humanitarian assistance. A lot of agriculture came to a stop, a lot of trade came to the stop. And you have areas, especially in Darfur and Kurdufan and these areas, where people are eating leaves. You know, it's like the amount of suffering and the hunger crisis is insane. The death toll from the war is something that we still don't have a solid number on, because most of the areas don't allow any international observers or anything to go in. I saw some estimates of like 15 or 20,000. I can guarantee you it's closer to 500,000, you know, between people who've died directly from the conflict itself and people who died from, you know, the secondary effects of the conflict, whether it's hunger, whether it's disease. You know, there's cholera, there's dengue fever, there's all kinds of also, you know, pandemics going on at the same time. So as much as I can try and explain how dire the situation is over there, I just can't do it justice.
Finally, is there any way out of this? It seems really kind of hopeless, but I would hope that it's not hopeless.
Yeah, so there's a few tracks. You know, there's immediate ceasefire and a humanitarian pause are being negotiated right now. And that's, you know, by the countries who actually have influence on these parties. So it's the U.S., the UAE, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. They created something called the Quad, where the four countries are working with SAF and the RSF to come to an agreement on a three-month humanitarian pause. So that's still being negotiated right now. And I think, especially after the Al-Fashir massacre that happened a few weeks ago, that kind of increased the pressure a little bit. And the idea of cutting off the arms from the UAE and, you know, from these countries are being discussed right now. Not enough, but the focus right now from these countries is trying to get to a humanitarian pause and hopefully lead to a ceasefire. There's been other movements, like, you know, the BRICS nations have tried to contain the conflict by adding these regional actors. In 2023, you know, they added Ethiopia and Egypt. They also added both Iran and the UAE, you know, as opposing countries in the region that are running proxy wars and stuff. So they added these countries as a way to see if there's a development path out of this and, you know, negotiations, but not a lot has come out of that. The African Union is also working on having a comprehensive Sudanese dialogue, you know, among the different political and civil forces in Sudan that are on both sides of the war and the majority who are not involved in the war and want the war to stop and are calling for peace. You know, so these are slow moving initiatives, but, you know, there's high hopes that if a humanitarian pause happens, at least there can be a conversation of how do we permanently stop the war.
That was Mossab Baba. You can find a couple of his articles on Sudan on the Black Agenda Report website. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Long Way Out of Pain from John Cale's Mixology Volume 1, released in May. It features the Nigerian drummer Tony Allen. Next, Japan's new prime minister, Sanae Takeuchi. She's gotten a lot of attention for being the first woman to get the job. Her politics have gotten less attention. They are appallingly reactionary, as we'll hear. Takeuchi is a protege of Shinzo Abe, who served as prime minister from 2006 to 2007, and again from 2012 to 2020. Abe was the son of an important politician and the grandson of a former prime minister. And like his protege, Abe was also quite right-wing, as are the principal figures in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, which has governed Japan with little interruption for the last 70 years. Among the right-wing affiliations of Abe and the LDP elite is the Unification Church, founded in 1954 by the Korean preacher Sun Myung-moon and led by him until his death in 2012. His name is why the organization is known in the U.S. as the Moonies, a term they find derogatory, but okay. Abe was assassinated a couple of years after he left office by someone whose family suffered at the hands of the church. And the whole LDP crew has deep ties to the Japanese mafia, the Yakuza. While they're not quite what they used to be, the Yakuza are still an important force in Japanese life. Their major rackets are drugs, of course, and cheating old people out of their money through a variety of scams. They were once famous for disrupting the shareholder meetings of large corporations, blackmailing the firms, and harassing other shareholders with considerable success. They still do this, but they're off their game. Takeuchi shares her mentor's reactionary agenda of authoritarianism and remilitarization. For decades, Japan capped its military spending at 1% of GDP. It's approaching four times that in the U.S., but that barrier was broken in 2022. Last year, it was 1.4%, and Takeuchi wants it higher. She's also anti-democratic and xenophobic, like the rest of the LDP. As we'll hear, back in 2016, while she was serving in Abe's administration, she declared that the government had the right to shut down broadcasters it deemed politically biased. The Obama State Department worried in that year's Human Rights Report that this represented a threat to the freedom of the press. Now, of course, we have a president who agrees with Takeuchi and an FCC chair, Brendan Carr, who looks all too willing to carry out the boss's wishes. Here with more is Jake Edelstein. He's lived in Japan since 1988 and has done investigative journalism there since 1993. He has a Substack called Tokyo Paladin. Jake Edelstein. Before we get to the recent developments, let's talk some about the venerable structures of Japanese politics, specifically the domination by one party, the Liberal Democratic Party. They pretty much run the country with very few interruptions for the last 70 years. Who are they and how did they do it?
The Liberal Democratic Party, if you look back in history, is kind of an amazing story because it's very well documented in the book Legacy of Ashes, A History of the CIA by Tim Weiner. I know as soon as you say the CIA, people are like, what are you talking about?
But okay, it's a safe space here, don't worry.
All right. The United States was fearing that all of Asia would go red, turn communist. After helping Japan set up what it was a wonderful constitution that guaranteed equal rights for men and women, rights to housing, fair trial, all of these things. The socialists were doing very well in the polls, and they decided that they wanted to make sure Japan didn't go red by funding a conservative party to be called the Liberal Democratic Party. The joke about the Liberal Democratic Party is it's never liberal nor democratic. They reinstated former war criminals. One was Kodama Yoshio, who was a war profiteer, heavily connected to the Yakuza, Japan's organized crime groups, especially the Inagawa Kai. And also Kishi Nobosuke, the grandfather of Shinzo Abe, who was the minister of munitions during the war, and also with Sasakawa, later the founder of the Japan Foundation. And so these three guys, with funding from CIA, helped create the Liberal Democratic Party, which swept elections in the 50s and essentially established one-party democracy in Japan. And their goals were, because you have Kishi Nobosuke and Kodama Yoshio on there, was to undo what everything had been done by the Allies, which was to get rid of this constitution, which they hated, and remove basic human rights, popular sovereignty, and the clause that prevented Japan from going to war. All things the Japanese people had essentially voted on and said were okay. Being sponsored by Yakuza money and with a sort of Yakuza figure in the background, they very much are kind of like a Yakuza-like structure. The way that members of the organization refer to senior members is they call them the Oyabun, meaning like the godfather. I mean, even the terminology and the behavior and the factionality of these different groups within the LDP, the Abe faction, the Taro Aso faction, echo kind of the structure you would see in the Yamaguchi-gumi or the Inagawa Kai of like warring factions within a organization all vying for power and control what is done. And the party has constantly been plagued by pay-for-play scandals and cronyism and backdoor slush funds and instituted disastrous policies like building nuclear power plants in a country that is in the middle of the geological ring of fire, which resulted in several nuclear accidents long before the terrible one in 2011. I would argue that they've done a terrible job of managing the country. If you look at the price of the yen and the number of unemployment and the problems with the empty houses and a huge debts as they keep spending money that they don't have. They have been ruled for many years, but they're fairly incompetent and they're very authoritarian.
Okay, so now they have this new prime minister, Sanae Takaichi. How do you pronounce her name?
In Japan, we usually do. Well, I see. Yeah, I'm going to say we because I've been there so long. We usually say Takaichi Sanae. What's the last name first?
Okay, and so if I want to refer to her briefly, I'll say Takaichi.
Yeah, right. Takaichi.
Okay, now we're supposed to applaud, of course, the breaking the glass ceiling, but she's not exactly the ideal pioneer for doing that, is she?
No. Sanae is the puppet of Aso Taro. Now, who is Aso Taro? Aso Taro is Abe's right-hand man, the son of a munitions maker in World War II. I think he's in his 80s. An extremely adept power broker, dresses like Al Capone, loves manga, was one of Japan's most incompetent prime ministers ever to exist. And he also said something, which is really relevant, that got him in a lot of trouble around 2013. He said, why don't we learn from the Nazis and just change the constitution when no one is looking? So he is one of the brainchilds behind something called the Emergency Powers Act, which immediately after being elected, Takaichi-san has been talking about. And the Emergency Powers Act is essentially just like what was in the Weimar Constitution, which allowed Hitler to take power very quickly. In the case of a national emergency, the prime minister is able to suspend the laws, make laws, imprison people who are causing trouble, and essentially replace the Constitution with authoritarian rule. That is one of her big important things that she feels needs to be added to the Constitution.
She's a bit of a Hitler fangirl herself, right?
Yes, she wrote, there was a book written by a Japanese politician called Hitler's Election Strategy, and she enthusiastically blurbed the book. If you can find old copies of it, you can see like on the wraparound cover of it, there is, you know, a quote from her. And she has been caught hanging out with neo-Nazis and getting photographed with them. And of course, classically, everyone in Japan says, oh, I had no idea who these people were. I just happened to be in a photo with them. The same thing happened with Shinzo Abe was caught in a photo with, weirdly, Mike Huckabee and Nagamoto Ichu, who is the Kaiser Soze of the Yamaguchi-gumi, that is Japan's largest organized crime group. And, you know, Abe was like, I was photobombed. No idea who this guy is. So while Abe is claiming not to have any idea who this guy is, it was very well known that Nagamoto was essentially Shinzo Abe's political emissary to all the organized crime groups to get out the vote for Abe when he was running for prime minister in 2006, before actually becoming prime minister in 2007. Here's a weird thing about Japanese politics. To become prime minister, you have to become the head of the party. And to become head of the party, there's a certain number of votes allocated to people who are in the National Diet, parliament. And there's a number of votes that are given to the regional offices that people pay dues to join the Liberal Democratic Party. So they have a say in that vote. So you can't just win on the votes of people in parliament. You need the support of the rank and file. And so in Abe's case, and this is the same with Koizumi, you used to have these Yakuza emissaries go down and talk to all the local Yakuzas who are also involved in politics with the Liberal Democratic Party and say, okay, you need to get out the vote for our candidate. And then that could tip the scale so your guy could be prime minister.
You've mentioned Abe a few times. She's a bit of a protege of his. Tell us about his reign. He was in office for quite a long time, assassinated shortly after leaving office. But what was the Abe regime like?
Abe was one of the longest running prime minister since after World War II. The Shinzo Abe had this vision of making Japan a military power again and throwing off the shackles of World War II. And he was obsessed with changing Japan's constitution and making it an imperial constitution in which the emperor was not just a figurehead, but actually had significant political power. His goals on this were very clear. Actually, there's a wonderful meeting that was secretly taped, and you can find it on YouTube, of Abe and his group at a meeting of a group called Sosei Japan, Recreating Japan in 2008. And his former minister of justice is saying, okay, we as the LDP have created a new constitution and we're putting this forward and we're going to hope that it gets accepted. And he says, but I have issues with it because we still have things like basic human rights. We have popular sovereignty for the people and we have this clause of pacifism. And until we get rid of these things, Japan will never have a real constitution. We will never be back in action. And everyone wildly applauds. And of course, Abe is applauding the loudest of them. That is what they want to do. They want Japan to be an imperial power again. They don't want to apologize for war atrocities during the thing, and they want to be a player on the international stage with weapons and armies and control over the peasants, because they're very elitist. You know, they don't see themselves as being the same as the ordinary people. That was always Abe's goal. Professor Nakano at Sophia University said, you know, even Abe's Abenomics plan, this plan to revitalize Japan's economy, which failed, was never more than a sexy cover for distracting people while he went to work on his secret agenda, which is making Japan have stronger espionage laws, restraining the free press, which he found to be a tremendous thorn in his side, and changing the constitution the way he wanted. And it's quite specific in his own writings. Actually, his mother, of all people, after he died, wrote a wonderfully long essay on all the things that she had hoped her son would do. Those in the know that Abe's mother really was kind of like Abe's political advisor, crazy as that is.
You mentioned Abenomics. I remember reading about it in the Financial Times, and I never really could make sense of what it was. But so you said it really didn't do much and didn't work very well. What was the legacy of it?
The legacy of it is you have a country of what used to have only 10% of the population was temporary staffers, which now it's about 40% or more. So the permanent employment, which was a great source of Japanese power and strength and also social quality, has been decimated under the 8+ years of Abe and Abenomics. The monetary policy was great for big corporations who wanted to buy with no interest. But at the same time, all the old people who had put away money in savings, where they're getting a zero interest or 1% interest, have watched the value of their savings disintegrate. So it has resulted in a country that is much poorer, greater income wealth disparity. And, it was supposed to have three big arrows: fiscal easing, and then changes in monetary policy, and then finally innovation. And, third arrow, innovation, new businesses, never came. It was always just monetary easing and spending money on public works projects and things that usually only benefited the LDP crew. But one of the things about Abenomics that was the most interesting in a sense is Abe did something that was really kind of brilliant. And you can kind of see this with Trump doing this with the Labor Statistics Bureau in the United States. He created a cabinet personnel office, which had never been done, which determined 600 of the most powerful posts in the Japanese bureaucracy. And so what does that do? That means that every bureaucrat who wants to rise to a higher position in their agencies has a sort of incentive to give Abe the figures that he wanted. In Japanese, that's called sontaku, like reading the mind. And so they did. So it turns out, and this was barely reported in the West, that many of the stats that were reported as signs that the Abe administration was doing well and that Abenomics was working, including increasing number of construction, increasing number of jobs, turned out to be completely false, absolutely made up data, or a restructuring of the criteria of certain data so that it would appear to be better than it was.
I'm afraid that sounds familiar. Okay, so let's move on to the new woman in the block, Takaichi. What kind of regime is she likely to run?
She is Abe in a blue dress. I mean, everything that Abe failed to do, she's already trying to do. Japan has serious problems. Serious problems with old people, serious problems with maintaining the funds for the excellent public health care that they have. You know, it certainly has some issues with China, and issues with over-tourism. It has issues with real jobs for people, not part-time jobs, but real jobs. You know, permanent employment, the things that people want. So Nikkan Weekly Gendai, a Japanese magazine, asked her, what is the most important thing on your agenda? And she's like, oh, we need to pass the spy prevention law. Japan is just riddled with spies. When someone pointed out to her that Japan already has the Japan State Secrets Act, which the United Nations has constantly criticized as a poorly written law that could punish, get a reporter sent to jail for just asking a question, she says that the problem with that law is it's not proactive enough. They should be able to instigate the arrest of someone by merely asking them if they know about a top secret, or if someone mentions a top secret without knowing they're a top secret, that could be enough to get them arrested. Whatever is defined as top secret. So, of course, what is top secret? You wouldn't know. So it's kind of Kafkaesque. So you ask the wrong question, bam, you find yourself in jail. The law is poorly written and it's very Orwellian. And that is our number one priority of all the things in Japan that you think Japan might need right now. A spy prevention law, which is called the Spy Boshiho, is an insane thing to be making your top priority, which most of the Japanese public is opposed to.
I'm speaking with the journalist Jake Adelstein, an American who's been living in Japan for almost 40 years. She has a lot in common with Trump and company, notably xenophobia. It's not Haitians eating cats and dogs in Japan, but it's they're hurting the deer, she says. What's that all about?
Oh, yes, yes. They're punching and kicking the deer.
And they are unspecified foreigners?
Oh, yeah. Foreigners. Yeah, the foreigners. The foreigners are coming to Japan to punch and kick the deer, the sacred deer of Nara. The deer of Nara are supposedly emissaries of the gods. So, you know, so you get the mix and a little bit of Shinto nationalism is there as well. On her stump speech to be the prime minister, she said two incredibly false things. One is that there was evidence that foreigners were coming and punching and kicking the deer in Nara, and this was terrible. And the other one was that there were so many foreign criminals that the prosecutors were dropping charges because they didn't have enough interpreters to handle the case. The response of prosecutors in the legal community was that's an absolute lie. If you understand how they treat foreigners, they were never going to let off a foreigner because they couldn't find an interpreter. And the Nara Parks and Recreation said, we don't have any recent records of foreigners punching and kicking the deer. And Takisan, kind of doing a J.D. Vance, said, I have my own sources.
You mentioned the Shinto nationalism. This is like the World War II people, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There is a Shinto political lobby called Nippon Kaigi that most members of the Liberal Democratic Party belong to. And they are staunchly opposed to equal rights for women, equal rights for foreigners, having immigrants. And they want to make the emperor a god again. And this group, Nippon Kaigi, I think in the LDP, is 80 to 85% are members of Nippon Kaigi, which is very, very conservative, kind of like the John Birch Society of Japan, except with a fondness for Shinto gods. And so she has strong ties to them. And the weirdest thing about all of this is the incredibly conservative Unification Church, which is a Christian group founded in South Korea, has tremendous influence over the Liberal Democratic Party. It's one of the reasons Abe got shot. And Takeuchi-san also has had strong ties to the Unification Church. And much of the policy of the Liberal Democratic Party seems to align with what the Unification Church puts out as their policy. So they're kind of anti-LGBTQ bent. And those things are similar to the platforms that you see in the Unification Church of Japan.
Here, back in what, I guess the 80s, even into the 90s, the Unification Church was very tightly allied with the Reagan right. And they've sort of disappeared from view. People don't talk about them much anymore here, but they're still a force in Japan.
Yes. So not to praise Yamagami Tetsuya, the guy who shot Prime Minister Abe. I don't think many people know this. You stop me if you do know it. Why did he kill Abe? And the answer was, Yamagami's family was devastated by their relationship with the Unification Church. The mother became a staunch believer. She basically gave away all of the family's money, the money that Yamagami would have gone to college. His brother committed suicide. Yamagami ended up in the self-defense forces to put his way through school. And he's a bright fellow. As he realized that he would never be able to take revenge on the Unification Church by killing the leader of the group, he decided that the best thing to do for the sake of Japan and for other members of the cult was to kill Shinzo Abe, because Shinzo Abe and many members of the Liberal Democratic Party had been supported by the Unification Church in their elections, financially, and in getting out the vote quite vocally. And that if he killed Abe, it would draw attention to this horrific relationship, and then it would remove the Unification Church from power and maybe get their religious license stripped away. And he wrote all of this in a manifesto that was actually quite well written, sent it to a journalist, and then probably thinking he would be killed in the action, he went and assassinated Shinzo Abe. In terms of how political assassinations went, it was incredibly successful, because once people started looking at his reasons and why he did it, they discovered a very weird nexus between several LDP prominent politicians and the Unification Church. And Takeuchi-san is one of them as well, who was benefiting from the aid of the Unification Church. And in her current cabinet, she reinstated two or three people who, you know, were infamous for having ties to the Unification Church.
Now, as for the Shinto nationalism, this is very closely tied to trying to rehabilitate Japan's reputation in World War II and to sanitize the record of all the war crimes. And I guess that's also a way to lubricate the remilitarization. I imagine she's a total partisan of that agenda.
Oh, yeah. Remilitarization is a huge part of the thing. She wants to divert the Japanese budget to 2% to military buildup, arguing that, you know, China is a threat. And meanwhile, Japan is very quickly, on the government level, changing the regulations that would allow Japan to export weapons. So, you know, Japan is a country that in its constitution says we have forever renounced war. Even the army is called the self-defense forces. So for Japan, this, you know, pacifist country to suddenly being like, we're gung-ho on making weapons of death, isn't a good look for people who are constitutional scholars.
But they're going to plunge ahead with this agenda anyway.
Yes, they're going to plan ahead with the gentry. Another thing that I'm seeing that is very much a reminder of Shinzo Abe is, I don't know many people know this anecdote, but when Abe first went to congratulate Trump on winning in 2016, one of the things he said to Trump was this: why don't you do to the New York Times what I did to the Asahi Shimbun, which is Japan's most liberal newspaper, criticize them and punch down at them until they are silenced or living in fear of you. And Sanai, as the Brendan Carr of Japan during her reign as a communications minister, summoned the heads of every major network in Japan and said, if you continue an unfavorable reporting of the administration, we're going to pull the plug on your broadcasting. Like, we will take your license away and you will disappear from the airwaves. And that was tremendously effective. After meetings like that, the three most vocal critics of Abe disappeared from the news. All these people who are critical of the administration, the government, like, just vanished from the airwaves.
And speaking of Trump, has he reached out to her? Do they have any kind of relationship?
Oh, they get along wonderfully. She got criticized in the Japanese media for being like fangirling over Trump, like jumping up and down when they're on the stage together. There also is hilarious footage of Trump visiting like the Royal Palace, and he gets lost and she guides him around like a little boy. You know, with her hand on his arm, like taking her doddering uncle on a tour of the workplace.
Oh, yes, that was very touching. I saw those.
Who knew that she could be so maternal?
Where did she come from? I mean, she just an LDP functionary? How did it become her moment?
In her youth, she was like, you know, everybody writes about this. And it's like, oh, she was in a heavy metal band. She, you know, rode a motorcycle. You know, she was a rebel. Sure, she had her youthful rebellion, but she joined the LDP very early in her career and quickly rose up the ladder and shown that she was just as fierce and just as nationalist and just as able to want to rewrite history as any other hardcore conservative former war criminal in the LDP. During the famous Murayama speech, in which he, for the first time, Japan publicly and, you know, and probably best made a sincere apology to all the suffering they'd caused in Asia for colonizing Korea and making all the Koreans forget their own language and learn Japanese. She was like, if we apologize to these foreign nations, no one will respect Japan. We should never apologize. We should never apologize approach is so Trumpian, right? I never apologize, so I'm never wrong, so I always win.
Trump was right about everything, as he says in his hat.
Yes, Trump was right about everything.
What are you expecting? Looking to the crystal ball, the debased journalistic practice of looking to the crystal ball. What are you expecting from her term in office?
I'm expecting more financial disaster. I expect the yen to sink more because she wants to revive Abenomics, and that is a failed economic strategy. You can't just have fiscal easing. You actually have to spend money intelligently. You know, if you want to solve these other problems like Japan's failure of marriage, people won't have kids. You have to fundamentally change the way that Japan works, and that includes providing childcare, maybe actually getting rid of the temporary staffing laws and putting laws back that would force companies to hire people for life. The permanent staffing people is something promoted by Pasona, Nambu, Hizo Takenaka, these powerhouses in politics. have been great for some Japanese corporations, but they've been so bad for the rest of Japan. Because I can explain this in a game, you know, in a sense, because that indicates to you, humor indicates to you how true something is. Takara Tomy makes a board game called The Game of Life. It's hugely popular in Japan. I don't know if, have you ever played it?
No, never heard of it.
Probably forgotten in the US. It's, you basically spin a wheel, find a career, and then whoever has the most money at the end of the game wins. So there is one version of this that came about 8 years ago called The Hellish Game of Life. And in that game, just like in real life, as you graduate from college, you get one round. And if you land a corporate job, you get the 30% bonus every year. You get the full coverage of your insurance. You get all the amazing perks that you get as a permanent employee. But if you end up as a free timer, a freeter is what they call in Japanese, a part-time worker, then for the rest of the game, you're constantly in debt. And you're constantly landing on spaces that deprive you of, you know, the money that you need to survive. So you're guaranteed to lose. And it's such an ironic commentary on Japanese society. It's like you miss your chance to get that job for life with Sony or Mitsubishi or Mitsui and start work as a temporary staffer. Well, when 5 years go by, they fire you. Because then if they kept you on as a full-time employee, they would have to give you all those benefits. So you're permanent underclass. And Japan has created this permanent underclass of people who don't have the opportunities that the corporate warriors have.
That was Jake Edelstein, the American journalist who's been living and working in Japan for decades. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Standing Next to You, also from that recent John Cale album, Mixology Volume 1. Till next week, bye.